We're talking about it. This is Hamilton Today with Scott Thompson on 900 CHML.
Hey, it's Hamilton Today. I'm Curtis Thompson, Scott's son. Major Tom McKay is on the board. Wild Will Erskine booking the guests. And the legendary CHML newsroom Dave Woodard and Jennifer McQueen. Here's Scott Thompson.
Yeah.
Here we go. It is Hamilton Today. I'm Scott Thompson, 900 CHML. Sad day in the Hamilton music scene. And the reason that we'll be playing Junkhouse Top Hour tunes throughout the course of the show. Very sad news to hear that Russell Wilson, bass player for Junkhouse, has passed away at the age of 62. I really know very little about this out at this time, just that it was very, very unexpected. And sad news to report today, Russell Wilson, bass player for Junkhouse, passing away at 62. Of course, I just saw them, and I'm trying to think of when it was, and it was just before Christmas. It was the same day as we were broadcasting in Gore Park for the CHML Christmas Tree of Hope campaign, and then went down to see Junkhouse at Bridgeworks. And it was just an incredible show, and my wife and I are such big fans, as you probably know. And it was great to see them together, and you know, with a couple of extra musicians. And you could really see what Russ added to the band, and the flair that he added to the band, and the soul that he added to the band. And very, very sad to hear. As you know, I know they had, Tom had mentioned that they had some gigs coming up this summer that on the festival circuit and such. So very, very sad to hear the passing of Russell Wilson, another great Hamiltonian member of Junkhouse, passing away at the age of 62. And as we find out more on that, we'll certainly pass that along. All right. What do we got going on today? A lot of people are still chatting about the Hamilton cyber attack and, you know, why we're not hearing more. At the beginning of all this, you can certainly understand why. First of all, they probably don't know what's going on. And secondly, it's a security issue. But as the days and so, you know, go by, more and more people are looking for information and asking why the mayor hasn't come out and talked about this. So we'll talk about that coming up a little later on as well. And, you know, on the sad day that we've lost Russell Wilson, and you know, I'm going to talk about this next news item, and then I'm going to move on to something more positive, because really, you know, people are just feeling deflated, which is an interesting word, just with, you know, life in general and such. But, you know, here's something that really, really sort of struck me today. And, you know, like most of us, I live in a pretty good neighborhood, you know, it has issues every so often, but it's a great place to live and raise your family, as it is in most places in Southern Ontario. And, you know, it just, shocking over the last couple of years, a little while, how much crime has increased, people getting their homes broken into that you'd never hear of before, people getting their cars stolen multiple times that you would never hear of before, you know, kids getting their bikes stolen, you know, even people taking Christmas decorations off of houses. Or, you know, we had one situation, and a neighbor, or somebody in our neighborhood had a beautiful, evergreen tree out in front of their house, and somebody came in and buzzed a great portion of it away, probably like to make wreaths, like to have the boughs at Christmas time. Like it's just, you know, it's absolutely nuts. You know, we've got stories of Loblaws putting in scanners now because too many people are stealing things. You know, the LCPO is dealing with this. But what really stood out to me was the Toronto police, and this has come out in the last week or so. Remember, it was all about, you know, if you've got a key fob, your car can get stolen so easily because they just reprogram it and off they go, and yours is useless. And now I don't even think they need the key fob. They just need a laptop, and they plug right into the port in your car, and they make their own. So, you know, and there was that big thing about protecting your key fob. We used to have Lorraine Sommerfeld on that, talking about, you know, having a box or this or that or a bag or something that puts, well, you know, our neighbor had that and it's gone. You know, his car's gone twice. So, You know, you're, and so now we hear today, so they say, do all this about your key fob. Do, but you know, where are you supposed to put your key fob? Up your rear end? Like, really? Where is it safe? So now the Toronto police are saying, leave your key fob right at the front door. Because people are breaking into homes and stealing cars. They don't want anything in the house. They just want the car. They don't want your money. They don't want your laptop. They don't want whatever you've got, your jewelry. They want your car. So rather than, you know, getting roughed up or hurt or killed for your car, let them get the car and take off. That's the Toronto police that are saying that. Toronto police, because they are seeing what's happening. They're on the front lines. They're seeing people getting rolled in their own home in a home invasion for the damn car. And there's people get, you know, we hear the top 10 list of the, you know, luxurious cars that are stolen. They're all getting stolen. Your minivan's getting stolen so it can be used in a crime to steal the expensive car. They're all getting stolen. And it's like, you just got to shake your head and think like, what is going on? And we've got a prime minister that stands up and it says, it's not my job to be popular. It's to do the right thing. Then resign. Because you're not going to save the planet on the backs of Canadians. We've got to live. We got to survive. And the prime minister has completely ignored all of that. Completely out to lunch. It's not my job to be popular. Well, you've succeeded at that. But yeah, you know, your own hood. You've got like, what the hell's happened? Look around your own hood. See all the Trudeau tents. What the hell is going on? And a man who's oblivious to it all and bring on the next carbon tax, April Fool's Day. This is fascinating. And it's an interesting article from David Moskrop. And he's written this for the Globe and Mail. Letting 16-year-olds quit school to go into skilled trades. What can go wrong? Facing a labor crunch that would affect housing, construction and transit infrastructure, Ontario has amended a program aimed at secondary school students and the Ontario Youth Apprenticeship Program. Under the new program, grade 11 students can now choose to stop their high school education and take on a full-time apprenticeship. What could go wrong, writes David Moskrop, contributing columnist with the Washington Post, host of the podcast Open to Debate, Left Looking In, as well as the author of Too Dumb for Democracy. David, thank you for the time. I hope you're well.
I'm fantastic. Thanks for having me.
You know, obviously, David, we know what the issues are in and around the economy and in a post-pandemic world and such. It does, at first blush, look like an interesting idea. What can go wrong? And, you know, it's interesting. I'll preface this by saying I have a 16 and a 21-year-old. And I remember years ago, as we're picking their high school courses and then on into post-secondary or university or college, I was always concerned that things were becoming too narrow too soon. And this is even more so, perhaps.
I think that is the fundamental problem. I want to start by saying we need folks in the trades, and those who want to go into the trades ought to be welcomed there. We ought to encourage it. I spent years in university and then and now have a serious problem with people who denigrate the skilled trades and pretend that university is the only path or the better path or so on and so forth. The trades are an essential path and we ought to be paving it for people. My concern is that asking someone at 15, 14 to start thinking about this and shepherding them down that line at 16 and saying, well, don't worry, you can maybe graduate as a mature student later, closes their options early, too early. And on top of that, and this is a warning that comes from Unifor, who represents something like 50,000 of the sorts of workers the Ford government wants, Unifor worries that this is going to water down apprenticeship requirements, lead to low completion rates, and put the health and safety of these folks at risk. That's more or less a quote from one of their releases. And that's a serious concern that I've got, especially in a program where the completion rate is in the 30s.
Plus, you know, again, it's hard enough for kids that are graduating school trying to figure out what they're going to do next or what their post-graduation options are. But to now make that decision even earlier just seems bizarre. Here's the other point, David. Who's to say because you get into the trades, you can't have a university education? I know lots of anecdotal situations where people have both and have advanced as a result of that. So therefore lifting the level of education in the trades.
Well, exactly, or a university, or a college for that matter. And I think a lot of people are saying, well, what's wrong with folks finishing high school, getting work after college or during college, right? I mean, so that they get a better education, so that they're better prepared, so that they're older and more mature and safer on the job site, right? Which presumably we all want. And again, the rates of the high school completion are low. They're in the 30s. And if you look at data from StatsCan, we know that people who have a post-secondary education in the long run out-earn those who don't. So, it's in the interest of these young folks that in the long term, they have that education in particular as a backup, as well as for prep in the trades as well.
You bring up a valid point, David, too, and that being safety, there is a certain maturity level there, too.
Yeah, and this, again, this is one of the concerns that Unifor has. Unions, particularly unions who are representing folks in the skilled trades, want their workers to be safe. They want them to have a reliable, safe, high-paying job, and safe is absolutely critical. And, you've got a 16-year-old on some of these job sites, and it's going to be risky. And if the union who specializes in this is telling us that it's going to be risky, well, yeah, we certainly ought to take them at their word, because they would certainly know. But one of the things that drives me particularly bonkers about this whole thing is that we need people in the skilled trades because there's a dearth of folks, and there's a desperate need for, among other things, people to build housing. And so all of this is coming about because governments, not just the Conservative government in Ontario, but the Liberal government before it, and even the NDP government before it, have failed to plan and prepare for this. So now they're putting all of that on young folks in Ontario, and I don't think that's fair.
That's a very valid point. So this is pretty much an easy fix, a short-term solution, not seeing what happens 10 years down the road. And really, does this speak to how desperate the housing shortage is? And is this really an efficient way to go about doing it? Are we going to get that many more homes built if we open it up to younger people?
Well, it's definitely a response to that. And if you read the media coverage of this and you watch what the Ford government says about this, it's always tied to housing. We don't have anywhere near the housing starts in this province that we need to try to generate some measure of affordability. People are struggling right now to pay their mortgages. They're struggling right now to rent, and it's getting worse. And the housing market may very well heat up this year. It's already starting to heat up, and we're nowhere near the starts. But the idea that we can solve that by pressing a bunch of 16-year-olds into the trades now is laughable. For one, again, the completion rate is low. Two, there's a huge lag time on that, which doesn't mean we shouldn't prepare for that, but it means it's not going to solve the problem overnight. And in the meantime, we're essentially treating these young people as fodder for to sort of pay a tax on the failures of government for the last few decades. I don't think it really constitutes a serious plan for addressing the housing crisis, or for that matter, the infrastructure and transit crisis that the province faces.
As you said earlier, and I've said this many times on this show, this is a self-inflicted wound. I mean, build has been a bad word for the last 5, 10, 15, 20, 25 years, what have you. Are we learning from this, David? Are we coming up with a plan, a solution, a strategy, so we can balance what we take in to what we build, what our services can sustain? Are we learning anything here?
My God, I hope so. There's a quotation, I don't remember who it's by, and I don't remember the exact wording, so I'm going to paraphrase, but it's something to the extent that the worst society is the one that sort of praises mediocrity in thought and denigrates excellence in the trades, because neither their ideas nor their pipes will hold water. And I think that resonates a lot today, because we spent years under-preparing our society for the challenges we face, under-investing in the state programs we need, pushing people away from skilled trades into universities they never wanted to be. I think this is a reminder that we need educated folks, but we need educated folks who can go into the trades as they wish. And we can have both. We can both prepare students for life as critical thinking citizens and folks who can navigate the world and also be in the skilled trades. The idea that at 15, 16, we say, well, no, higher education isn't for you. You can just go into the skilled trades and learn on the job is unreasonable. That's effectively giving up on these students who can do both. And I think our government should have a little bit more faith in young people and their capacity to do both of those things at the same time that we start to invest in the long run for the infrastructure and housing we need to keep people healthy, safe, and in lives they can afford.
And how many times do we see young people all of a sudden, boom, the light goes off and off they go? David Moskrop with us, contributing columnist for the Washington Post, host of the podcast Open to the Debate, and left looking in, as well as author of Too Dumb for Democracy and the latest in the Globe and Mail right now. David, thank you so much for the time and insight. Much appreciated. Be well.
Always my pleasure. Thanks so much. You too.
For some Loblaws customers in Ontario, their next grocery run might look a little different. Canada's largest grocery company confirmed that it is testing receipt scanners at four of its stores in Windsor, Woodstock, Oakville, and Georgetown, part of a pilot project to stop retail theft. To talk more about all of this, Marvin Ryder, professor, DeGroote School of Business, McMaster University. He is here now. Marvin, thank you for the time. Hope you're well.
I am. Glad to be with you, sir.
Thanks for taking the time. How will things look different or feel different if we go into one of these stores?
Mm-hmm. Well, Scott, if you just put in a little context for you, I view self-checkout and all these other different variations as grand experiments at this time. To give you an example, it's not a Canadian example, but in the United States, Walmart has unveiled an approach called Walmart Plus, where you pay about $12 a month, and then you get to use priority checkout counters. So no standing in line for you if you're a Walmart Plus shopper. You get to go over here. They're also experimenting in their stores with giving you a device. And as you put items in your cart, you scan them with the device. So when you get done, you don't even really go through a checkout. The device itself just says you owe this. You tap your credit card and off you go. Now, the one downside to self-checkout, at least in grocery stores and department stores, is this question of theft. Can we trust everybody? So, you know, I'll check out the lower priced items, but I'll stick in a few higher priced items. How are they ever going to know the difference? And there are some nefarious individuals who use self-checkout as a way to steal, in other words, from the store. So they're still experimenting with this. I don't think any of this is set in stone. And correctly, I think people who get upset about this say, wait a minute, you say you're using self-checkout to save money, but then you're putting people in to check. How did that save you anything? You're paying the person who's checking my receipt the same amount that you paid when you had somebody there doing it. I don't see where there's any great savings. All I can say is, sort of, if you will, self-checkout has worked fine with gas stations. Hardly anybody goes to a full-service gas station. I'd actually think you'd be lucky to find one. Hardly anybody uses a teller at the bank anymore. We go online and do things or do it at an ATM machine. So finding ways to automate is and can be done. It may require that we use artificial intelligence. I visited a robot store last year when I was in, of all places, Lithuania, and the store told me these are the items you took from the shelf and then had me pay for them. I didn't scan a thing. It already knew using cameras, I'm assuming, in the room. So we're experimenting a lot with these technologies to find the way to get people through the best way possible.
If you go to Costco or are a member there, they routinely do this. I understand it's even part of the agreement. Why does nobody question that, yet we're questioning this one?
Well, of course, at Costco, you buy a membership. And everyone who doesn't have a membership, who tries to take advantage of Costco pricing, they're trying to beat the system. So if you're someone who's bought a membership, and I try to go in there and poach, for lack of a better term, what's going on here, yeah, stop him. Make him pay for the membership. Make him be just like me as we go. That's not right. That's not fair. So it comes to our inherent sense of fairness. Now, out of Loblaws, we add another layer. And of course, Loblaws seems to have become, whether Galen Weston meant to do this or not, our favorite grocery store to hate. They've become the poster child for everything that's wrong in retailing today. So they're making too much money. Their profits are too high. Their prices are too high. Galen makes too much money. And so this is going to be another thing that gets layered on. I'm not, again, sure he should be taking all this flack, but he, you know, they're experimenting. And at the end of the day, they're trying to give consumers what they want. What you never hear in these stories are the consumers who get really fed up standing in lines. And I must have picked the wrong person. Why is it taking so long? And inevitably, the story is you get behind Mrs. Johnson, who's trying to fish a coupon out of the bottom of her purse or trying to get the correct change. Oh, come on, lady, move it. I've just got. So these stories go both ways.
Getting back to the Costco thing, is it really about checking your membership? Because what I've found whenever I've been there, and believe me, my wife, she knows better than to try to drag me in there anymore. They're not really looking for your card. Maybe on the way in, on the way out, they're looking at your bill, and then they're look sort of scanning your card or your box or whatever. So it really is the same thing, and it seems odd because we're paying for that membership, and yet they're still shaking you down. So it's funny how it's accepted there, but not in the grocery store, when really, they're really both doing the same thing.
Right. Except the idea is that you bought a membership for this. Now, I would argue membership should
have So then, Marvin, you're paying to be shaken down. It's like, oh, because I paid, then I lose that right, which seems the opposite to what would be the case.
No, I on that front, I agree with you. But the whole idea of privilege is, if I have a privilege, why are you doing this to me? Somehow, right. Though, in a grocery store that doesn't require you to have a membership, it seems, again, like you don't trust us. And again, it's a small minority of people. If I go back to gas stations, once upon a time, I filled up my gas and then I paid for it. Now they make you prepay for it because too many people were filling their tanks and then driving off without paying. It wasn't everybody. It wasn't more than 5%, but it was a big enough percentage that it was making it hard for the gas station to function. Now, Ian Lee, during the broadcast, he's a colleague, if you will, at Carleton University. He made the point that theft costs us all money. And if enough people start stealing, then again, prices are going to go up some more to cover the theft. So I think what is reasonable here, I don't mind showing my receipt because I haven't taken anything. I haven't done anything wrong. Yeah. So if you want to double check it, there you go. Help yourself. I'm fine. It's a bit like at the airport when they're double checking that I'm the right person to go with the right boarding pass. Mm. Thank you. I'd like you to make sure that all the right people are on this plane and not any terrorists or something else. So I'm fine with it because I don't feel I have anything to hide. But there are people who are just mad about self-checkout. Anything about it is wrong in their mind, and we should go back to other systems. And on those people, there's nothing to make them happy.
So at the end of the day, you said this was a work in progress. Where do you think it's going to settle down to the point where, because we see this a lot, where there's a, if you want to walk through a checkout, you've got that option. If you want to do a self-checkout, you can do that. In a lot of cases, I'm seeing like in a grocery store with self-checkout, if it's a smaller purchase as opposed to like a grocery cart full. And then, of course, the person at the end checking to make sure nobody's stealing anything. How and again, is it worth having all of these gatekeepers per se, or should you just embed that into the price of the product and everybody pays for it, as you were talking about?
Yeah, I'll just say it a little differently, Scott. I think, and again, I'm not trying to veer this conversation in some strange place, but this world of artificial intelligence that you heard a lot about, we have barely scratched the surface of what artificial intelligence can do. And I think as we are looking at the way retail stores operate, if we're trying to get people in and out faster, allow them to use whatever method of payment they want to use, whether it's a credit card, debit card, or their phone or something like that, we will use more artificial intelligence in the future. For the moment, these are interesting experiments where they measure costs and benefits, both to the retailer and to the consumer. Where do you get the most satisfaction? I think 10 years from now, retail will look even more different than it does right now. I don't know how, but I know once artificial intelligence comes in, we may be able to get rid of some things altogether. Just like banking today is not like anything my parents knew, just like gas stations today are not like anything my parents knew, I think retailing 10 years from now will look quite different. But I'm not just sure what it's going to look like. So these experiments help shape the face of it.
Marvin Ryder, professor at DeGroote School of Business, McMaster University, the changing face of retail. And it's not over yet. Marvin, as always, thanks for the time. Be well.
I will. Thank you.
Canada's airline market is once again back on a path towards consolidation. What can travelers expect? What does this mean? How cyclical is this? Let's bring in Barry Choi, travel expert, and with us now. Barry, thank you for the time. I hope you're doing well.
I'm good. Thanks for having me.
So, Barry, talk about the health of the airline industry, the travel industry right now. Are prices high? Are prices coming down? Are load capacities where they should be? Where is this industry, where we are in the world economy, post-pandemic, whatever you want to call it?
Oh, it's all over the place. You know, as far as passenger loads are concerned, we're still seeing record numbers overall. But as we're going to discuss shortly, we're seeing fewer airlines within Canada. And what's interesting is just a few days ago, American Express released some new data, and they were saying Canadians are expected to be the second biggest country to spend the most money as far as travel is concerned So it's a really interesting time for Canadian travelers. But if you're traveling domestically or even internationally, our choices seem to be getting smaller or fewer.
But the demand is still there in post-pandemic. People still want to get out and go. Even and are prices higher? Are they going up? Are they coming down a bit post-pandemic?
You know, the prices definitely went up immediately after the pandemic. I would not even like, it's kind of like, I don't want to say over, but I want to say prices started to really start to increase May of 2022. So 2 years later, we're still seeing huge prices. To give you an example, last year I went to Hong Kong with my parents. And normally pre-pandemic, a return flight from Toronto to Hong Kong would cost about $1,800 at max. That would be considered really, really expensive even then, right? Mm. Now you'd be lucky to get a one-way flight for $2,500, right? Oh, so obviously it depends on where you're going. If you're going to certain sunny destinations like Florida, it's not as expensive, but there's definitely a trend gone upwards. And it's fair to say that the cost increases as far as airplanes, even eating out and hotels, is significantly higher than what we're seeing with day-to-day inflation.
And obviously, if there's fewer options, that means there's more seats being filled. Who is consolidating?
Well, it feels like everyone these days, isn't it? You know, I think it was last year you and I had discussed Swoop basically being pulled into their bigger parent company, WestJet. And we literally had this discussion. We're like, is it going to lead to higher prices? And I was like, you know what? It's definitely not going to lead to lower prices, that's for sure. And now, like, you know, those fewer destinations, there's less options. We just saw... Sorry, Lynx Air. I just wanted to make sure I'm not naming the wrong company here. Lynx Air, they just folded up shop. They declared bankruptcy. They are no longer flying. I actually flew Lynx Air. It's actually really sad because, again, less competition. It was an airline that was trying to do good, but it's just the economics of it just didn't make sense. So there are fewer players these days, unfortunately, that will probably mean higher prices. So that's why Canadians got to do whatever they can to save money.
So why, Barry, are these airlines, smaller airlines, having issues if the demand's so high and the load is high? How come they're not making it go? If a discount airline doesn't work at this time, when does it work?
Well, I think it really comes down to Canadian consumer habits. Like, let's be realistic here. How many people are really itching to jump to fly to, say, Hamilton to Winnipeg, right, where you've got traditionally two airports that have lower fees, right? Whereas in Europe, you're talking about airlines that are flying from London to Amsterdam, right? And they've already got the infrastructure there. We've obviously got a much lower population compared to other parts of the world. A lot of Canadians forget that. On top of that, Canadian airport taxes are some of the highest in the world. So there's so many things working or not working in the favor of these smaller airlines. It's actually quite sad. There's just no competition there. And at the same time, the Canadian government has a lot of rules with Canadian airlines, so it's hard for them to get foreign investors to really build things up. Because, you know, sometimes you might need to spend money to make money, and unfortunately, sometimes you're just going to run out of money.
And, you know, again, you brought up a valid point. Many forget this is a huge country with a relatively small population.
Yeah, that's exactly it, right? So even though people want to save money, if my option is to fly directly to Vancouver as opposed to Abbotsford, I'm probably going to choose Vancouver. It's not like in Europe where you've got easy transit access. Even when I was in Asia last year, it doesn't matter which airport you fly into. It's actually still really easy to get to where you need to be. So it's less of an issue. And obviously the population levels in Europe, Asia, and the U.S. are significantly higher than Canada. It's a smaller distance. So airlines are spending less on fuel. So it just the economics and this everything plays into their favor. And unfortunately, with Canada, we've seen many airlines come and go, and I'd be surprised if another airline tries this again.
You said many come and go. Is this highly cyclical, or is it? Or is it just incredibly difficult, and the majority will fail, some may succeed? I mean, is it cyclical because of population, country, that thing?
I feel like they're all set up to fail. Porter might be the one exception, and at the same time, you know, Porter, when you think about it, they kind of had a good deal in the sense that they weren't really paying much for the island airport. And from what I understand, I believe they actually owned it for a long time. But they were able to really just kind of build up their reserves before they really had to go anywhere else. They were really smart about their business plan. You know, they had smaller planes. They only focused on smaller airports that had lower fees. And once they finally kind of built up that brand, only then did they expand. You know, when you think about in the last year, only now are we seeing Porter fly internationally, and even the planes they acquired, you could argue that it's good timing, because I believe it was a Brazilian company that were just looking for a partner, sold the planes to Porter for really, really cheap, because they're like, look, our planes work. And Porter, to their credit, took advantage of that situation.
Canada's airline market on the path towards consolidation. Barry Choi with us, travel expert. Barry, as always, thanks for the time. Be well.
No problem. Anytime.
If Scott Thompson isn't satisfied with an answer,
he'll delve into the issue until he is.
You're listening to Hamilton Today with Scott Thompson
on Hamilton's News, Today's Talk
900 CHML.
We eventually called Carmi Levy, technology analyst and journalist, to pop in and talk about the GCS strategies. This is the contractor behind ArriveCan, but you know that crisis will continue forever in the debate and the in committee and whatever it is. More interestingly, the whole battle of TikTok. So we'll try to squeeze it all in. Carmi Levy, technology analyst with us now. Carmi, thank you for the time. I hope you're well.
Great to be with you, Scott. Thanks for having me.
So what are your thoughts on the buzz about TikTok and what's happened in the U.S.? Overwhelming politicians on both sides of the House asking for this.
Yeah, I mean, you know, we've been saying for years that TikTok has some significant security concerns compared to other apps, which every app that you install on your phone collects data. That's just the way they work. We give them permission when we install them, and then we forget that we ever gave them permission. What's different here is that TikTok collects even more information. It is known as an aggressive harvester of data. And then, of course, once it's collected more information, it's where it goes that's even more concerning, because this isn't an American tech company. They're owned by ByteDance, which is a Chinese company. And we know that Chinese companies, in order to be allowed to do business in China, they must sign a deal with the Chinese government. That if the government asks for their data, they must comply. If you don't, you're out of business. And ByteDance says they haven't. We know we don't take that at face value. It doesn't hold a lot of credence. And so bottom line is, it's collecting a huge amount of data that then through a whole lot of research that's been done, we know full well, it's not compartmentalized. In other words, it's entirely possible that the Chinese government, and there is evidence that that's the case, has had access to it and can use it in all sorts of ways. For example, I don't know, maybe convince us to vote a different way in an upcoming election. We know that the Chinese government uses information technology, uses access to data as a tool for geopolitical power, and they certainly wouldn't stop at this. So you put it all together in that innocuous app that you have on your phone that lets you, you know, watch cat videos and videos of people dancing and, you know, the latest viral craze. There's a lot some more insidious stuff going on underneath that we probably should be more aware of. And that's what this bill, this initiative is all about, is reining it in a little bit and cutting down that risk.
You know, Carmi, when we used to watch those clips on Dick Clark's bloopers and practical jokes, we weren't putting our lives at risk. But anyway, let me ask you this, Carmi. How is this conversation any different than the conversation around 5G and Huawei, which we all know the five eyes all said, nope, that ain't going to happen. They can't be part of it. And eventually Canada jumped on board. We know that government devices are not allowed to use or have TikTok on them. So how is this any different from that discussion with Huawei and 5G?
It isn't. I mean, there's a lot of overlap. There are also some differences, but the overlap is that there's a clear and present danger apparently coming from China through information technology. And so the question has to be asked, is there a legislative way to cut down the national security risk? And in the case of Huawei, it was outright ban them from bidding on providing hardware and software on our national networks. And that ultimately happened. And same thing here, don't allow the app on the phones, on the devices of Americans, and then you cut off that channel that way. So in that respect, they're very similar. And they're also similar in that we're deluding ourselves if we think that that's going to magically solve the problem. In other words, take one app away or take one company like Huawei away, and suddenly you think you've solved the Chinese data surveillance issue. No. That's not the way it works. There are millions of other apps in the Google and Apple app stores, and I'm sure a lot of them have some sort of Chinese ownership or Chinese connection. And so if you ban TikTok, the Chinese government will simply refocus on other apps if they haven't already done so. I'm sure they have.
And here's the other thing. We, as you just said, other apps involving Chinese companies here, yet no North American companies allowed to have the same thing there. So how can they complain that we're banning TikTok when nothing's even allowed there?
Two words, Scott, because China. It doesn't have to be logical or rational. You know, China's got its own worldview, and they certainly won't halt, or they won't take this sitting down. In fact, I would fully expect them to already be preparing their retaliatory actions against American interests. For example, they, like, you're absolutely right, they ban most American companies from doing business in an open and free way in China. If you're a tech software developer or a services provider, you can't. Most major American platforms that you and I take for granted are blocked in China. So in a way, this is kind of tit for tat, but China, of course, doesn't see it that way. So yeah, you know, it isn't fair. It isn't bilateral. It isn't even by any stretch of the imagination, but you know, this is China. This is how they work. And this is how they've decided to exert their influence geopolitically. And we have to find reasonable ways to counter that, protect our interests without actually becoming them in the process. It's, you know, when we go down that route of, okay, we're to protect our national interests, we're going to ban this app, or we're going to threaten to ban this app if we don't force the company to sell itself. How do we differentiate between, say, an app and a book that our kid reads in school or wants to take out from the library, or music that, you know, we ban because we see it as subversive? So do we simply use blanket bans every single time we see something we don't like, or are there other ways to achieve national security without being seen as infringing on freedom of expression, freedom of speech, and not being seen as federal censors?
And again, I think it goes back to what you said earlier about harvesting data. Here's another thing. A lot of people, and we only got a few seconds left here, Carmi, a lot of people are screaming and yelling, don't touch my TikTok. Is this the best we can do? Are there not really bright techies in other parts of the world that can create the next TikTok?
Sure there are, but it's like, you know, we've been talking about who's going to create the next Twitter. Right now that Elon Musk has ruined it, no one's been able to do that. You can't recreate lightning. And sometimes, even though, for example, Instagram with its reels is essentially copying TikTok feature for feature and is succeeding and is growing very rapidly, it's still not that sort of magic in a box that TikTok is. And so you will see the industry attempt to do it, but I wouldn't hold my breath. It's not the way these things work in tech.
But if you still unscrew the TikTok light bulb, somebody's going to put something else in the room to light it back up again. It will then not give the others opportunity.
Sure, they will. But if you release a hit song, and I try to create a song, not everyone's going to necessarily like it. That's not the way it works. And human interest works very differently. It isn't logical.
Good point. On guitar, Carmi Levy, technology analyst and journalist. Always fun, Carmi. And once again, we didn't get to the original topic we were going to talk about, but that's what's so cool. Thank you, Carmi. Be well.
Appreciate it, Scott. Thanks.
Don't go away. We're coming right back.
You're listening to the Hamilton Today podcast from 900 CHML.
We were talking, had Carmi Levy on, a technology analyst, last segment, and didn't even plan to talk about TikTok and Blammo. There we go. Because everybody has an opinion on it. Writing for The Conversation, Professor Doug Jacobson looked at whether governments should ban TikTok and if they can. Doug Jacobson is with us, professor of electrical and computer engineering, Iowa State University, and here with us now. Doug, thank you for the time. I hope you're doing well.
I am. How are you doing, Scott?
So far, so good. So what is the challenge in banning this? Is it as easy as we think it is? Is it turning off a switch?
No, it's not nowhere near as easy as turning off a switch. You know, these apps are already on, in the United States, 143 million phones. And they could force, I guess, Apple and Google to remove it from the Play Store, but there are lots of ways to get apps onto your phones. So it's going to be pretty difficult for them to get them off the phones that people already have them, and B, keep them off of new phones.
So what's the solution here, Doug? Just let it be?
Well, I think there's a, you know, from a technology standpoint, I'm not sure we can actually ban it, as they're thinking. I think some of it deals with, this is probably a play to try to force ByteDance to get rid of Chinese ownership, maybe be a little more open and transparent about what they're doing. I think some of it also comes back to us as parents, us as users, to be aware of what TikTok collects and how TikTok might be using what they're collecting. So be a little bit more informed consumer.
What is the difference, Doug, between this discussion that's going on right now regarding TikTok and the discussion over, or the debate there was a few years ago over banning Huawei from the 5G? We remember the Five Eyes all said, no, we don't want Huawei involved in the backbone of our 5G networks and such, and that was banned. Why is that situation, or is it, different from banning TikTok?
Yeah, I think it's a little different. There was concern, you know, that was equipment that they were unsure of its security, and that equipment was, you know, that was part of the integral part of the network. Here you're talking about an app that's in the hands of a consumer, and a lot of what people have been talking about has been, yeah, theoretically possible, but no necessary proof that the People's Republic of China has been doing anything. But what people have been talking about is technically feasible.
I'm not sure that the discussion here is around proof or not proof. It's whether it can be done or it can't be done. I mean, we're dealing with election interference up here. So there's really no, the proof argument doesn't really go anywhere. Everybody just assumed that this is what is going on. But at the end of the day, with getting back to the 5G comparison with Huawei and this with TikTok, at the end of the day, I realize they're two different things technically. One's an app. One is the backbone of a 5G system. But this still is a security issue. The problem is still the same.
Yeah, the problem is potentially the same. You have an app that we don't know what's going on inside. We don't know the algorithms they're using. And the app has the ability to potentially manipulate, you know, hundreds of millions of people. The app has the ability to collect data. We don't know why or how they would use the data. But anytime a potential adversary is collecting large amounts of data, that's always a concern. And so, yeah, there are similarities. I think it's the issue that this is in the hands of the consumer, which kind of makes it
right.
The consumer is now more upset. You know, nobody, for the most part, nobody cared about the 5G pulling for the 5G. There's 143 million upset people right now.
Yeah, no, I hear you. And I got a couple in this house right here. That being said, what is the process? What would need to be done to flick the lights off for TikTok here in North America anyway?
Well, from a technical standpoint, it would probably require modification of your phone's operating system to detect and not allow TikTok to run. Because again, you can download any app from anywhere. It doesn't have to be the App Store. So it would require Apple and Google to implement something on their phones to prevent it from working.
Is there, even if they did shut it down, is there stuff that is still there that theoretically could still be a threat?
There's a potential that something's in your phone. That's probably, you know, if you deleted TikTok, it's a little less probable that there's going to be some remnants left behind. Mm-hmm. It's again, more of, you know, you can't really force people to delete it. So you'd have to have technology that would force the deletion of TikTok.
Can you block it in any way from coming in? Is that what the, you know, in layperson's terms, that's what it is? You're blocking something from going in or out?
You potentially could try to block access to the TikTok servers.
Let me ask you this, Jake or Doug. How does, Doug, how do other countries, like communist countries, whatever, stop our stuff from getting in? And yet we can't stop their stuff from getting in, because obviously a lot of the American stuff can't go into China or any of that sort of thing. And they protect their people from seeing this. I mean, obviously some still do, but how come they can do that, but we can't do it at this end?
Well, from a technical standpoint, what they have done is they basically, you know, they all are talking about, it's the second Great Wall of China. Yeah. And so they've built an environment that is basically nothing comes in unless they let it. We here work on a premise of everything goes in and out, and then we try to find some things that violate whatever laws, rules, and we block those. So we have an allow all, stop right. some. They have a deny everything, allow a little. and so that's easier to manage when you've basically closed your country off and you're only going to let these one or two things come in.
Where do you think this is going to go, Doug?
It's going to be interesting. It'll end up in the courts, I'm sure. I've heard that there's been people that are starting to look to raise money to be able to buy it. I think it'll be interesting to see whether if ByteDance is offered enough money, if they will relinquish control. And if they don't, then that may feed the fire of the fact that they have another motive to keep it besides money.
Doug Jacobson with us, professor of electrical and computer engineering, Iowa State University, writing in the conversation, talking about whether TikTok should be banned and if it can. Doug, fascinating discussion. Thank you for the time. Be well.
Yep, you too. Thanks, Scott.
We talked about this the other day, and you know, like, honestly, I thought I had missed, like, I eat and breathe this stuff. So, I'm following news all the time. So when all of a sudden, hey, what happened there? I never heard about that. And I think it was the union leaders representing the LCBO that said, talking about privatization, stop the cuts, the sale of the LCBO, stop the sale of the LCBO. And I'm so like, I start going online and saying, well, did I miss a story here? Like, go to the website. Do we not have something here? Do we not cover this? What's going on? And then you realize it's a protest that's going on. And what they mean about selling off the LCBO really means opening up more distribution to places like your grocery store or your local corner store or what have you, which is hardly selling off the LCBO. And then the premier called them out for that. What does it mean? Is there a sale going on under the covers? Let's bring in Dan Malik, Associate Professor, Department of Health Sciences, Director of the Center for Canadian Studies at Brock University, and here now. Dan, thank you for the time. I hope you're well.
I'm well. How are you, Scott?
So far, so good. So there been chat about selling off portions of this, or is this sort of a secret way of selling things off by opening up more distribution?
If anything, it would be the latter, in the sense that, Doug Ford has been very clear that he wants to break the monopoly of the beer store. It's not really a monopoly anymore, but virtual monopoly. And also then winery, like the winery distribution, which was mostly LCBO as well. Beer was not mostly LCBO. Anyway, so what this could do is reduce the demand for the LCBO stores, right, in certain communities. Right. So it could be that what the union is looking at is not so much the sell-off of stores, but the decline of workers in those stores, right? Because if you remove a liquor store from a community and there's nowhere else to get booze, you're going to have illegal sales, right? So it might be more they're going to the extreme of saying, they're going to shut stores, and there may be some shutting of stores, but I think what the union's concern is loss of their members' jobs, because there won't be demand for them.
Right. So this is more about unionized employees with the LCBO, although the grocery stores that they're working in are also unionized. Somebody's still got to stock a shelf, whether it's across the road or not. At the end of the day, if we have the option of buying it somewhere else, will that lead to the shutting down of LCBOs? Because I can't see even your stores having the selection, the bonus of the LCBO and how it will survive in all of this is the depth of its catalog. Is that
exactly
not accurate?
Yeah. And so, I mean, remember that apart from those sort of lower alcohol mixed drinks, like the Ryan Cokes in a can and stuff like that, supermarkets, corner stores, other vendors will not be selling like the 40s or the 750s right. of vodka and all that stuff, right? So that will still need to be under the recommended under the plan, and we know this government changes their plans sometimes, the plan is that those will still be only available in the liquor stores or in the LCBO stores, right? So yeah, and you're right. I mean, the LCBO used to be known as like one of the biggest purchasers in the world because it had such a vast market, right? Sort of captive market, I guess, for booze. But when you start putting, you know, beer and wine in corner stores, to your comment earlier about the unionized workers, yeah, in some supermarkets they're unionized, but in the corner stores they may not be, probably
right,
aren't,
right?
You know, so there's that issue as well. But yeah, to your first question, right, like the LCBO is still in a very strong position. Whether the premier starts to open up the opportunity for other vendors, like you don't have to close the LCBO to open up the possibility for other vendors to sell spirits. Right. So that could be down the line, but he's never talked about that as far as I know.
So this is sort of keep our jobs versus more options for the consumer.
I think what it is keep our jobs, people being afraid for their jobs. And that's, I think, a very legitimate concern.
Sure.
When, you know, you have a lot of people stocking wine and beer. It may not be as big a concern because, again, if your go-to place is this large place where you can get spirits, wine, and beer, people might still keep going there. And some supermarkets have found that the booze that they are selling isn't as, I guess, lucrative or as much of a draw or whatever as they wanted. So you know, yeah, we're starting off on a very uneven playing field. If you want to look at this as a free market issue, right? That the LCBO has a very strong pole position, but they are, as a union, their job is to protect their workers' jobs, and they're, you know, you take the rhetoric to the extreme of, you know, if they're going to shut down the stores, saying our workers are going to lose their jobs isn't as strong a message to consumers as they're going to shut down liquor stores.
How does this, and we've only got a few seconds left, how does this resonate with Canada or with Ontarians? How does this resonate with the consumer?
It's really tough to say. This has always been one of those things. I mean, I think this is why he took so long to go back to this. I mean, he started with Buck a Beer, which people didn't really resonate because people are like, yeah, it's going to cost more than that anyway. So it's really hard to say whether this resonates with people, whether this is something that could be an election issue. So I don't know. I mean, people have wanted more choice. They, you know, they like going to the beer stores. I tell you, I just came back from England where you can go to a supermarket and buy spirits and it's not like, you know, Deathmatch 2000 out there, right? But people are always afraid of that. They're always afraid that we've talked about this before. The world is ending when anything is looser. So it's hard to gauge whether people are excited or interested or whether they really care because they can get their stuff anyway, right?
We've come a long way since filling out the pad of paper and handing it to the man behind the counter. Dan Malik with us, Associate Professor, Department of Health Sciences, Director of the Center for Canadian Studies, Brock University. Always fun, Dan. Thanks for the time. Be well.
Thanks, Scott. You too. Cheers.
When there's an issue, Scott is all in on getting to the heart of it.
This is Hamilton Today with Scott Thompson
on Hamilton's News, Today's Talk
900 CHML.
Obviously, it's been a couple of weeks now. The city of Hamilton hit with a cyber attack. Not much can be said for certain reasons of security during the early days of this, but then many now are asking why we haven't seen a little bit more transparency and perhaps even more from the mayor, Andrea Horvath, on what has been going on, especially when there's some people that haven't been getting paid. Let's bring in Larry Deanny, former mayor, city of Hamilton, and here now. Larry, thanks for the time. Hope you're well.
Scott, I'm doing very, very well.
So we understand we're going to hear more from Andrea Horvath tomorrow in the next day on this. Obviously, this is a sensitive situation for many reasons, but that being said, should the public have been hearing more by now?
Well, we're in the middle of an emergency that hasn't been resolved yet. And so now is not the time, I don't think, for the public to demand all of the answers, because as I've been reading about this ransomware, so it's not just a cyber attack, we're being held to ransom. And as I've been reading about this. When you're held to ransom, anything you say might be of advantage to the crooks that are holding us to ransom.
Right.
So I think discretion is the better part of valor here. And quite frankly, Scott, I travel in fairly wide and diverse circles. I don't hear anybody saying, we demand answers. What I hear people saying is, my gosh, it's got to be really bad. And I want this to be over. And I hope it's over and done with without too much damage to us as a municipality. And we hope that it doesn't happen again. I mean, those are the kinds of questions people are asking. Because I pay attention to these things, I have all kinds of questions that I'd love answers to. But I'm willing to be patient, knowing that those both elected and staff individuals at City Hall are doing things in our best interests. I mean, why wouldn't they be, given that the severity of this ransomware attack? So, I read Scott Radley's column, and I love Scott. I think, I agree often with the things that he says. And even in his column, he said, is it better to be discreet or should we be hearing more? And it's an open question, but the very fact that he's asking the question is probably forcing Andrea Horvath, the mayor, and maybe others to step forward even before they're ready to do so. My guess is, unless it's been totally resolved, in which case it's time to bring out the champagne bottles, my guess is that when the press conference is held tomorrow, we'll hear the same sorts of things, that we're working on it, we're making progress, it's a difficult situation, and we won't hear that many specifics. That's just a guess, of course, I have no way of knowing. So I would ask Hamiltonians to be patient. And in terms of people not getting paid, I understand people are getting paid. I saw that piece by Marios Bosterero, the president of the paramedics union, who has a provincial role, at least he did, I'm sure he still does, as well as a local one. You're saying that people are going to withhold their services if they don't get their money. Well, they will get their money. Now is the time to step up and be a patriot and be a citizen, and not to add pressure to an already pressure cooker situation. So I would ask Mario to just be a little patient on behalf of the city.
I completely understand what you're saying and would agree. If you're a victim to be hit, and we have to wait and see what the damage is before we can move forward on this. And the only concern I have had is for the citizens' data. That seems, yeah. Other than that, and of course the inability to get hold of services. But again, as you mentioned, be patient. That will all get up and running, yeah, sooner or later. Yeah. But the concern for the data, do you have any concerns about that?
Oh, absolutely. And you know, even the assurances have been sort of half-hearted assurances, because I don't know whether they fully know the extent to which everything is compromised, and we're hoping that it's not. I mean, at some point, I would say this as well. At some point, there is going to have to be a reckoning and a public declaration of what happened and how it might be prevented. And that's the time, I think, to ask all kinds of questions and also lay some blame if there's blame to be laid in terms of why they've done what they've done. But at this point, given that the crisis is ongoing, let's cut the politicians and the staff some slack, hope that they're doing the right thing, that they've hired the right people to get us through this mess, hope that the bad people that are doing this to us, and I understand it may be people from another country even, and so not really readily, yeah, accessible. Hopefully that they'll be stopped in some way as well. And then there will be time for full revelation of what happened, why it happened, and how it's going to be prevented in the future.
Any comments on insurance or how that would work? Was this even an issue when you were mayor?
Well, oh gosh, no. I mean, no, nobody even dreamt. Of course, this was all near 17 years ago now, so it was a different world in terms of technology.
Now. Yeah.
So we didn't have that. I know that Hamilton, in many respects, is a self-insured community. I also know that that they did have the foresight, at least, to get insurance for these cyber attacks, which have been proliferating across the globe and certainly in areas beyond Hamilton, but not too far beyond us. So they have some insurance. The extent of it, how much it covers, and whether it covers all the contingencies that we might be facing now is a question I just don't have the answers to. But the fact that they do have some insurance is encouraging, at least.
How do you handle this moving forward?
Well, gosh, and it's such a complicated world in terms of technology, right? Where people, both the individuals, by the way, and not just governments and entities as big as Hamilton, all of us are in danger of being hacked, and our personal information and so on being compromised. In fact, right now, I mean, about 6 months ago, I received a letter from a provincial entity saying that mine was a name that was compromised along with individuals who belong to this group. And I'm not going to divulge it because I don't want to embarrass anybody. But what they did for me is give me access to one of those credit rating agencies. And so every few weeks I get an email to them, and thankfully up to now, telling me that nothing untoward seems to be happening. But there we go. I haven't been part of this group for 22 years, but they had my data from when I was employed there. And they were hacked, and therefore I was hacked, and some of my information was compromised. So we are all in danger. And so I'm hoping that going forward, the city will learn a huge amount. In terms of did they get sufficient insurance and coverage, but B, there needs to be, you know, the firewalls. And I don't pretend to be an expert on these things, but I know the language at least. There need to be firewall protection, and then education for the 10,000 employees that we've got, all of whom have access to a computer, and they might be doing something totally innocent that has allowed these crooks to come in. And we'll probably get some indication of how that might have happened. I would hope that they are able to figure that out. And so you got to train people, not only in terms of the job that they're doing, but in terms of protecting the job that they're doing as well, which is a whole new world, isn't it?
Larry Deani with us, former mayor, City of Hamilton, talking about the cybersecurity incident at City Hall. Larry, thank you so much for the time. As always, be well.
Thank you, Scott. You too.
We hear a lot about it. Boy, the premiers are upset. I think it's like at least seven of them, including the Liberal Premier of Newfoundland, who have said, you got to pause the carbon tax, get rid of it, axe it, reduce it, do whatever. And, you know, when you think about it, the accelerator tax on alcohol, which was brought in by the government when inflation was relatively low and sets the prices of alcohol up. By inflation, they cut that back from 4.7 to 2%. I'm not sure cutting this in half is going to help or make anybody feel any better, but it doesn't look like that's an option as well. As the Prime Minister said, it's not his job to be popular. Well, he succeeded there. Let's bring in Dan McTagg, President of Canadians for Affordable Energy, former Liberal MP, and is here now. Dan, thank you for the time. Hope you're doing well.
I am. Thanks for having me, Scott.
So, Dan, a lot of people talking about April 1st. What exactly is going to happen on April 1st?
Well, as in the past 4 years, April Fool's Day tends to be the day the federal government's carbon tax increases. And, of course, this was supposed to end last year when we hit $50 a ton, but the government pushed it up to $65 a ton. In other words, increases every year of about 3.3 cents a liter plus HST right up until 2030. So another 5 years, well to go before this ends. This April 1st, we will see gas prices, as far as the carbon tax is concerned, go from 14.61 cents a liter, 14.31 cents a liter to 17.61 cents a liter plus HST. So a net increase of about 3.73 cents a liter. And of course, that would mean that gas prices, which will likely be a little closer to $1.60, maybe $1.62 by then, will then move to $1.66, and that will be permanent. The total one carbon tax is at that point going to be 19.9 cents a liter, and that is scheduled to go up by 2030, April 1st, 2030, to roughly 41, 42 cents a liter.
Okay, so that's I think where a lot of the confusion is, because you know we're hearing reports and stuff coming out of the media and whatever of, you know, gas is going up by so much percent, it's going to be you know, at the end of the day 20 cents a liter more, 25 cents a liter more, but that's adding it all together. April 1st we can expect about a 3 cent a liter jump in the gas. Is that accurate?
That's accurate, and it's ladled on top of the 16, 17 cents you're currently paying.
And as a result, how is this felt within the economy? The government is quick to point out that 80% of the people who get a rebate check, this covers all of that. How does this ripple through the economy?
Well, we know it doesn't. And politics aside, the arbiter in all this is the Parliamentary Budget Officer, who says that most Canadians will be worse off as a result of these artificial, arbitrary tax increases. For which you're forced to pay money and they'll give a little bit back. It's supposed to make you feel good about it. Not everybody's in that category, but the majority will lose more money than they will actually gain. The problem here is that it's not confined to strictly gasoline, diesel, propane, or natural gas. As the price impact hits, so say 20 cents on $1.50 a liter works out to 10, 11%. That's an inflationary number that is now applied to pretty much everything else that is impacted by gas, diesel, jet fuel, propane, natural gas, take your pick. What it really means is that you are accelerating inflation. And the last time I checked, it's very clear that the government, the Bank of Canada, is fighting inflation. And if you have a driver like energy pushing up prices arbitrarily, even though the price itself is probably not moving a whole lot of the markets, although lately it is, you know, you're creating inflation where inflation didn't exist. You're also impacting everything else, the cost of processing, the cost of transportation. Really, the supply chain is impacted by this. And so anybody who thinks that simply getting rebated what they think would be the average amount of gasoline or diesel used is fooling themselves into oblivion if they believe that they're getting back everything that they put into it and then some. There's no such thing as money growing off trees. And the idea that somehow you pay into something and get more back, well, that's just fanciful, magical thinking. And I think those who believe in that would probably have a better try at living in the world of magic and make-believe.
No, you got to admit, the best one, Dan, was if we cut the tax, we'll cut the checks. Like, if you don't get the tax, you won't get your check. It's like, well, you stole it from us in the first place. It's amazing how politicians can stand up and try to sell that, Mr. Seamus O'Regan.
Well, they can't. And, you know, I spent 18 years there, and guys like Seamus interviewed me on my work and prowess on energy. They used to look to me as the fellow who often gave them the advice on which way ahead, not just the media, but guys like Seamus when he was at CTV, and his friend Marcy Ian had me on Canada AM every week. You know, I'm absolutely amazed that they have completely forgotten the end user. The poor stiff on the street who has to wind up paying for this in more ways than just the price of fuel. Everybody is impacted. Everyone is impacted negatively, and we have nothing to show for it. Because if the battle is about a molecule, a gas called CO2, which is inert, if that is what we're fighting, then I got a better idea on how we might get a better deal in last winter's snow. Because frankly, I'm amazed that intelligent people are trying to, you know, make this some kind of turn this, you know, silk purse into a sow's ear.
We're going to save the planet if we just get rid of that last 2% of greenhouse gases, Dan. You know that. The rest of the world will be fine. We'll all be dead, but the rest of the world will be fine. Are you surprised at the reaction of the people and the premiers of late that have come out, including the Liberal premier from Newfoundland?
Finally. No, not surprised in Newfoundland. They followed the work that I've done at Canadians for Affordable Energy. All four of them came together to push back on the first iteration of the second carbon tax, which I should talk about. That's the clean fuel standard, so that it wouldn't apply to things like home heating fuel, coal, any form of energy that one needs to subsist. All four provinces pushed back on the federal government. They made some concessions, as we know, which got the rest of the country riled up, the rest of the premiers. What has surprised me is that I have been vocal to a large extent in tying the gasoline prediction to saying, if you have a problem with the energy prices going through the roof, why, oh, why would you permit your federal NDP Liberal government to continue raising the cost of living, which is what this does, without any possibility that it's going to impact global warming or whatever they call it, climate change. At the end of the day, what's shocking is that it took so long for them to get to this point. But now that they're here, maybe we shouldn't be looking strictly at the carbon tax. That's the low-hanging fruit. Let's look at the EV mandates, which are going to cost us 70, 80 billion bucks. Look at the 200 billion bucks of your money that's now been committed to green energy, for which there will be no economic prosperity coming from it, for which we are prepared to sacrifice jobs and economic momentum from the oil and gas sector, manufacturing sector, farm sector, in order to pursue this pie in the sky, trading the proverbial beanstalk for a farm. And that's what I'm more concerned about, is that we are not looking at, the reality of what is in front of us. Unfortunately, it's taken a lot of pain and politicians to finally wake up and smell the coffee and realize that what they've been sort of accepting with net zero has now led us down this dark path of, okay, you get rid of one tax. What do you do with all of these other programs that are coming under the branch of net zero? All of them damaging, all of them driving up the cost of living, all of them driving investment out of Canada.
Dan McTagg with us, president of Canadians for Affordable Energy, former Liberal MP on the carbon tax increases coming April 1st. Dan, as always, thanks for the time. Be well.
As well. Get some rest. Thanks there, Scott.
Joining us now, Scott Radley, host of the Scott Radley Show, coming up after the 6 o'clock news. Read him in your Hamilton Spectator. He is here now. Scott, thanks for the time. I hope you're doing well.
I am doing just fine. A little damp out there, but I'm doing just fine.
I know, compared to yesterday, my goodness. Oh, I wanted to throw this by you, and I'm going to blindside you here because I didn't take any of your other ideas.
Hit me with it.
By the way, Larry said you got to cut Andrea Horvath some slack, let them get their stuff together. Were your ears burning? He talked about you on the show today.
So I was actually on a phone call and I didn't hear the conversation, but it's,
I read Scott's column today and he brings up some great points and I often agree with Scott, but I think we need to cut Andrea and the city some slack until they get figured out what's going on. That's basically what he said.
And my
which is what you said.
My suggestion to that is the city has had a staff person, the city manager, coming out and answering or not some questions over the last 10 or 12 days. But to me, that's the role of the mayor. She's the one we elected. Yeah. She's the leader of this city. And we have not seen the mayor hardly at all. And
I agree,
to put the city manager who's literally worked for this city when this crisis started, she had been with the city for a month.
Yeah.
That to me is Andrea Horvath's role, but we can agree to disagree. Yep.
No, I understand what you're saying 100%. All right. By the way, I don't know if you followed the unveiling of the new Justin Trudeau countdown calendar. We're at 585 days today if you want to listen at 4 o'clock every afternoon. All right. Here's something that kind of really took me back. And you know, I'm kind of cranky about this. And I don't know if it's just because I'm getting old. I mean, you know, we all live in pretty good neighborhoods. We're all, we feel relatively safe. Our kids got a great place to grow up, all that sort of stuff. But now it's like there seems to be more crime, more car theft, more people's homes getting broken into, more kids' bikes getting stolen, more of all that crap. And now we're hearing Toronto police say after, don't put your key fob at the door, leave it in some sort of, titanium box, kryptonite, whatever. And now they're saying, just leave the key at the door because you don't want them banging in a home invasion and threatening your life just to get a damn key. So, what does this say, Scott, when it's just leave the key at the door? Why don't we just leave them in the mailbox? Throw them on the front step.
Yeah, why not just hang them, put a little hook on the front and say, yours if you want it.
You know how you've got the key thing to put your keys on? Put it on the outside of the house, maybe, is the way to do it.
So what I didn't catch in this story, because I saw this story today, there are many people who have other things in their house that are of some value, maybe not rising to the level of a car, but they might have nice electronics. They might have some art. They might have something. Yeah. Should we just have that in a box by the front door waiting for people? Why
have
just
a tickle
car?
Trunk, have a tickle trunk of everything that's valuable right at your front door. Everything, put all your art in there, your cash, your computers, your jewelry, everything.
This to me, and I kind of sort of not really, but I kind of get a little of what the police are saying, but not really.
Well, too many people are getting hurt. That's what's coming. Yeah. That's where this is coming from. You don't want to get hurt. You don't want to get hurt. So sure. Just give them the keys.
Sure. And we've seen this go online and you can watch all kinds of videos. We've seen this, especially in the States with stores. Like if people come in and shoplift, just let them and let them walk out. And there's millions of these videos, especially down in like San Francisco.
And you'll get fired if you try to stop
a lot of places. To me, this is it's the completely wrong attitude because it's essentially saying, well, we've now reached that point where we've jumped the shark and we really, you know, it's just going to happen. So just let it go. And that to me is the antithesis. We should be trying everything to not do this. I'm not necessarily talking about arming ourselves to the gills. Or setting up like Rambo booby traps in our front lawn for people who come on. But the fact is, Scott, how defeatist is this to just say your car is going to be stolen? So just whatever. No.
I know.
And you want to know what else is a problem with this? And I know police are working on the car theft thing, but we pay insurance premiums based in some measure, because it's also on accidents, but in some measure on car thefts.
Yep.
The insurance companies are not philanthropic enterprises. They charge money. They have actuaries who figure out what their share is and everything else. So for the police or whomever just to say, you know, we're going to have cars stolen. We can't do anything about it. It's not just affecting our car and the inconvenience and making our neighborhoods unsafe, but it trickles down. Now we're paying higher insurance premiums and all these other things. Probably more car manufacturers will almost certainly, because everybody wants to make a buck, put in extra more expensive security features as standard in any car now. So even that'll cost us more. The whole thing just strikes me as entirely defeatist and almost acknowledging that we have become like one of those cities in downtown Detroit at the worst moment Detroit had, when you wouldn't dare go down there. Surely that's not what we are. Surely.
Scott Radley coming up after the 6 o'clock news. Read him in your Hamilton Spectator. Have a good show, Scott.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to the Hamilton Today podcast. You can listen to the show live weekday afternoons from 3 to 6 on 900 CHML and online at 900CHML.com.
That's it for us. Thanks for listening. As always, we leave it to you, the taxpaying customer, to have the last word. We give to Steve via email, who's, look, he's patterned his last word after Hammerhead Trivia. He's calling it the all-new Liberal Game Show. And here's the question. It's not my job to be popular, says the Prime Minister. Is this A, scandal, B, blunder, C, misstep, or D, all of the above? In this game show, D could be the correct answer. As ever, Steve, keep right, except to pass.
Canada may be known for its landscapes and friendly people, but beneath the surface lies a darker side of crime, history, and the paranormal. Since 2017, the award-winning Dark Poutine podcast has explored the shadowy corners of the Great White North and beyond, delivering chilling tales from a uniquely Canadian perspective. Hosted by Mike Brown and Matthew Stockton, with over 300 episodes and fresh releases every Monday, Dark Poutine is your weekly ticket to the creepier side of Canada. Listen to Dark Poutine on Apple, Spotify, Amazon Music, or wherever you get your podcasts.